Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast, where liberty's our mission. Today is Wednesday, December 5th, 2012, and this is podcast number 241. You know, real quick note, the forum is continuing to grow, and if you are at all into forums, come over, drop by BadQuaker.com. On the upper right-hand side, you'll see the button for the forum. Go to the forum and look around. If it looks like it's something you'd be interested in being involved in, jump right in there. Make a make a login and be a part of the community. You're actually, when you do that, you're actually supporting BadQuaker.com, even if you don't, you know, give any money or anything like that. Just your presence being there, it draws more attention to the forum. And it makes BadQuaker.com pop up on Google a little bit better and things like this. If you want to support BadQuaker.com financially, that's great too. One of the ways that we're seeing a lot of activity is through Amazon. That we're really seeing a lot of response to the Amazon. But even if you don't want to necessarily put money into BadQuaker.com, you're supporting us when you go on the forum, when you make a post. You know, when you put a funny picture, whatever, that's all, that's, every bit of that is doing your part to help BadQuaker.com. And now, I've said this correction once before, but I want to make sure and have it on today's podcast. The other day, I was doing a podcast on the Mexican-American War, or the American War of Aggression on Mexico, or the first American invasion of Mexico, and I made the mistake of referring to James K. Polk as being a Whig. And he was not a Whig, he was a Democrat. His invasion of Mexico weakened the Democratic Party, and it caused a split in the Whig Party, and so it weakened the Whigs as well. And it paved the way for Lincoln's new Republican Party to eventually come into power. And, of course, Polk's lies, his failure to attack Canada like he had promised he would do, and his failure to annex all of Mexico like he promised to do, all those things together weakened both the two dominant parties, the Democrats and the Whigs, and really created a lot of the situation that required that eventually there would be, you know, Lincoln's war would eventually happen because of Polk's lies and his blundering and so forth. Also, you know, one of the things with Polk and his stealing of the old Southwest, of all the, you know, most of West Texas, all the way up into, like, part of Washington, Oregon State, Washington, no, not that far, but at least all through California and Nevada and Utah and all that. With him stealing all that, he didn't actually help the South. He didn't help the slave states like he promised he would, because what they found out almost immediately is that all that land was completely not suitable for the plantation system. And that's really, I'm going to get into that a little bit later in the podcast, but that's really what this is all about. It's perpetuating the plantation system. Slavery, of course, was a very important aspect of that, but it was only one aspect of the plantation system. I'll get into that here in a minute. And this is one in the series. This is actually the third in the series, building up to December 7th of this year, this coming Friday, when I want to do a podcast on the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor. And I want to lay the groundwork ahead of time so that you understand that Japan had absolutely no, or at least they felt like they had no options but to attack Pearl Harbor. And I'm going to show on Friday, if all goes well, I'll show on Friday that the Japanese government was manipulated into making that decision. But before I do that, my purpose in talking about the War of 1812 in talking about the Mexican-American War, and now today I'm going to be talking about Lincoln's War of Aggression. My intention in talking about these is specifically to show that that governments lie, that wars don't just pop out of nowhere, that there are real reasons, and these things build up slowly over time. And when you get down to it, and you get past all the lies, and you get past all the nonsense that comes with war and everything the government tells you in order to justify its aggression, what it really all boils down to is the government wants more power, and specific key corporations want more money. So it's really all about power and money. People in government grabbing more power and funneling money to people within specific banking and corporate interests so that they can get more power. So that's really what war is about. It always has been, it always will be. This is all that war is ever about. Okay, so now with this being, this podcast today being about Lincoln's War of Aggression, I need to give a slavery disclaimer. I am not for slavery. Okay, now the Quakers and, a bad Quaker, the Quakers were against slavery going into the 1600s. They were one of the first widely organized Christian group that was against slavery. But now that doesn't mean that most people were for slavery. If you go into, among poor people, and of course throughout Europe and throughout North America, most people would be, especially up until about the mid-1800s or so, most people would be considered poor. And poor people throughout the ages have always known that slavery was, just the rich people dominating the poor people. That's all it's ever been. So, if you could go back, it's not possible, but if you could go back and talk to your average guy just walking around in, 1650 or something, they probably would be against slavery. And most people didn't own slaves. Almost always through history, slaves have been owned by the rich, by the elite, by the power-controlling people. That's who is drawn to this kind of immorality. So the fact that the Quakers were an organized religion that was against slavery, that's true. But a lot of people were against slavery. Now, specifically, my family is from Appalachia. And you have to remember something even about the South. Slavery was bad for poor white families in the South, for poor, or even not necessarily poor, just family farms. If you had a family farm in the South, the plantation system itself was very destructive to the family farms. They would, continually drive family farms out of business as the plantations took over the land. So the your average, poor or relatively poor white family was not in any way slave owners in the South. And they were farmers just trying to struggle and survive. And this is the way it was in Appalachia. Slavery almost didn't exist in Appalachia in the, in the form that it did in the plantations in the South, because Appalachia was not suited to the plantations. They just wouldn't work out in Appalachia. So I'm not particularly, I don't really have a horse in this race, so to speak. I'm not a Southerner. I'm not from the South. I was born in California. So I'm looking at this entire situation from outside, having nothing to do with it and having no family ties connected to it. I'm not from the South. I'm not particularly, compassionate toward their views or whatever. I live in Ohio currently. I've spent a little time in Kentucky, but comparative to the rest of my life, it was a few years that I spent in Kentucky as a child. So I don't have any particular leanings toward the South, and I certainly don't support any human beings dominating any other human beings for any excuse whatsoever, whether that be race or anything else. So I wanted to get that out so that it's clear that this has nothing to do with race and it has nothing to do with sympathies towards the South or anything like that. I just seek truth, and that's all I care about. Now, if you keep in mind that slavery was not mentioned in any way in the Articles of Confederation, and there's a reason for that, because the Articles of Confederation were not an attempt to set up a federal government that dictated to the states how they were to behave. So... But now, slavery was very clearly a part of the Constitution. When the Hamiltonians, when the mercantilist types in the 1700s when they decided to, well, basically they had a coup and they took over the government. And you know, threw out the Articles of Confederation and set up their own constitution. When they did this, and in another case, in other situations, it might have that there might have been a war over that. But the fact that the American people had just gone through a war, and they were kind of tired of the war, and they really just wanted to be left alone. The American people allowed this to slip past them, and the Constitution was put upon them. And like I said, slavery was very clearly a part of the Constitution. It's in the Enumeration Clause. It's in Article 1, Section 9, where it forbids, where the Constitution forbids Congress from stopping the slave trade. And it was in the Fugitive Slave Clause in the Constitution. So you know, slavery was A, constitutional, and B, clearly defined as being such in the Constitution. And that was what some people were really upset about the Constitution. That was the reasoning for it. As a matter of fact, you know, Lysander Spooner, when some abolitionists were trying to use the Constitution to say, look, you can't have slavery because it says here that people are, you know, whatever. And Lysander Spooner took the Constitution apart, laid it all out, and said, look, this is what it says. The Constitution is clearly a document that supports slavery. And that was Lysander Spooner's argument. And who knew better than him? I mean, that was his expertise, law and the Constitution. So the Constitution clearly codified, or codified, if you prefer, the plantation system, and it set mercantilism as the foundation of the American economy. And it was intended that way. That's who, you know, if you look through the Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers, and you look at this whole argument between, you know, the Adam Smith, John Locke types like Jefferson and Mason, and then you look at the mercantilists like Adams and Hamilton. This whole argument was which direction economically, what's the economic structure of this union of states or of this collection of people? What's the economic structure going to look like? And the mercantilists like Adams and Hamilton, they wanted mercantilism as the system of the American economy. And people like Jefferson, well, Jefferson was a little fuzzy, but he was more in George Mason's camp, where they really wanted a free trade. They wanted a free market economy. And really and truly, now why am I talking about Madison and George Mason and Jefferson and Hamilton and Adams, and why am I talking about these guys when the topic is Lincoln's War of Aggression? Well, it's because Lincoln's war was set up with the drafting of the Constitution. It was almost guaranteed from that point on that at some point that this flawed document would create a situation where a war would have to take place between, you know, those who wanted to continue this system and those who wanted to preserve the old system. So with the Constitution, the dispute between the Jefferson Masons and the Adams and the Hamilton group, the dispute was basically settled by the political types, Madison and Washington and those guys. And this whole hodgepodge was morally flawed and economically unstable right from the beginning, because it kind of had 2 feet on different sides of a fence at the same time. It just wasn't possible. Let me, real quickly for you, let me read a little bit of what Wikipedia says about mercantilism, just so you have a kind of a running knowledge of what mercantilism is. Mercantilism is the economic doctrine that government control of foreign trade is of paramount importance to ensuring the military security of a country. In particular, it demands a positive balance of trade. Mercantilism dominated Western Europe economic policy and discourse from the 16th to the late 18th centuries. Mercantilism was a cause of frequent European wars in that time and motivated colonial expansion. Mercantilist theory varied in sophistication from one writer to another and evolved over time. Favors for powerful interests were often defended with mercantilist reasonings, And then here's the characteristics of mercantilism. High tariffs, especially on manufactured goods, are an almost universal feature of mercantilist policy. Other policies of mercantilism include building a network of overseas colonies, forbidding colonies to trade with other nations, monopolizing markets with staple ports, banning the export of gold and silver even for payment, forbidding trade to be carried in foreign ships, export subsidies, promoting manufacturing with direct subsidies, limiting wages, or I might just say wage control, wage and price control. I would have clarified that if I were doing the Wikipedia article. And maximizing the use of domestic resources. And restricting domestic consumption with non-tariff barriers to trade. So mercantilism was really an early version of fascism, where government and industry work hand in hand to control the economy. That's really what mercantilism was. But like this article in Wikipedia says, it was one of the things that was really indicative of mercantilism was these high tariffs and the attempt to control what people, you know, domestic consumption through use of tariffs and other barriers to try to manipulate people into behaving specific ways. And this was, you know, very much against what people like Adam Smith and John Locke had taught about, and it was very much against, you know, what Jefferson was talking about or George Mason was talking about. But it was exactly what Hamilton wanted. It was exactly what Adams wanted. And, you know, with the military at his back and his fortune to be made or lost on it, it's what Washington wanted as well. So all this was set up long before Lincoln came along. But what Lincoln faced was he was at a critical point in time where mercantilism was rampant throughout the South. Mercantilism being the system that supported the plantation system. So mercantilism was at its peak throughout the South with the plantation system. But Lincoln needed to move ahead to take the next logical step away from mercantilism, but still remaining in this weird marriage between corporations and the government. So what Lincoln had to do was Lincoln had to kill mercantilism and bring in fascism. That's really in order for him to accomplish what he really wanted to do. And you have to keep in mind that Lincoln was entirely a puppet of the northern banks, the northern steel industry, the northern railroads, and the huge northern timber industry. This is where he got all his money and he got his support and he got his votes and so forth. And so it was imperative that Lincoln crush the wealth and the power of the South and kill mercantilism and bring in the new form of mercantilism, which is basically fascism. And so that's, if we look at this and we see that that's really the goal in all that, then a whole new set of circumstances begins to pop in front of us that we can see exactly why things took place. And it wasn't just the simple childish reason, well, it was all because of slavery. No, it wasn't. Slavery played a role. And I'm going to get to that. Stick with me, I'll be right back. I'd like to talk to you about Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom. The Liberty Classroom is a collection of courses on history and Austrian economics presented in an easy, convenient way. There are video files and audio files you can download. You can participate in discussions online in the discussion boards. And there are live sessions with Tom Woods and the other educators where you can directly interact with the instructors. Now, who is this for? It's for anyone who realizes that they didn't get the real story in government-approved schools. It's also great for homeschoolers and unschoolers. Join Tom Woods and his team, and they'll equip you with one of the very best tools the Liberty Movement has to offer, knowledge, real knowledge in a usable form. At Tom Woods' Liberty Classroom, you can get all this for only $99 a year. Now, that's less than the cost of one movie DVD a month. This gets you access to absolutely everything on their site. All the courses, plus additional courses that will be added later, the discussion forums, the live sessions, everything. So how do you do this? You go to badquaker.com. You click on the banner for Tom Woods Liberty Classroom. By using that link, you'll let Tom know that I sent you, and you'll help badquaker.com. Thank you very much. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the commercial break. So Lincoln's war killed the Constitution as the foundation of government and created the modern corporate system, what we know as fascism. Now, other authors have used that phrase that Lincoln killed the Constitution, but that's really what I want to point out today, that you know the transition wasn't complete to bring the U.S. into a complete form of fascism. That transition wasn't completed until the Federal Reserve was adopted in 1913. But Lincoln's war made returning to a pre-1860s constitutional government absolutely impossible. It just broke the back of the Constitution. Whatever power that the Constitution had was crushed at that point, when it became clear that the federal government, the existence of the federal government was more powerful than the Constitution itself. Now, this is a good time to point out where my sources are from today. In the past, I've tried to put those out a little earlier in the podcast, but of course, I'm going to be, a lot of what I'm talking about comes from Thomas DeLorenzo's work and his two great books, Lincoln Unmasked and the Real Lincoln. And also, I'm going to refer some to a new book that's out by a guy named Joseph Fallon. It's called Lincoln Uncensored. And this is a really good book if you want something that is just a more like a reference than, it doesn't tell things in a storyline way. It's easier or it's better to use as a pure reference. It uses Lincoln's letters, Lincoln's personal correspondences, and Lincoln's speeches. And so you can, without the fog of all the historians telling you what to believe and what to think, Joseph Fallon's book just puts Lincoln's own words out there where you can read for yourself exactly what Lincoln was thinking and what he was saying to people, how he would lie to one group and then go to another group and tell them a different lie and pit them against each other. All of it's right there in Lincoln Uncensored. And I'll put links in today's show notes for these books. But the real one that you have to have, you have to have this book if you ever really want to get an idea of not just of Lincoln and his war of aggression, but of how the state works and how it functions to get wars going. You need to get your hands on a book called A Century of War, Lincoln, Wilson, and Roosevelt by John Denson. Now, that's my primary source for this. John Denson's lectures and that book, I probably learned more from that than anything else. And then, like I said, Tom DeLorenzo's work is really important as well. He goes in and gets a lot of the stuff that that John Denson didn't take the time to go into. But all of them are important, and you can find links at badquaker.com. Now, one of the things that that historians have complained about Tom DeLorenzo and him, how dare he write a book on Lincoln? He's just an economist. Well, historians talk about economics all the time, and they have no idea what they're talking about. You see this pretty frequently. And then you got a guy like Ken Burns. Well, the whole world falls at the feet of Ken Burns when it comes to talking about Lincoln or the so-called Civil War, all this kind of stuff. But Ken Burns is not, if you want to call him a historian, then you have to refer to him as a court historian, almost like a court jester, except not quite as funny. Now, I'm not saying Ken Burns is not talented. Ken Burns is a tremendous movie maker, and his ability in laying out a plot and laying out a storyline and then filming it and with heart-wrenching information and pictures and imagery and everything, he's a genius at it. But that's propaganda, and it's lies, and that's what Ken Burns does for the government. He produces lies so that people will believe in the myth of the government. So what we're talking about here, you can think of Lincoln as a person, as a lawyer, as a politician, as a president, or as Ken Burns would like you to think of him, as a god. And really, that's what the whole state myth is based on. If you think about so Washington, we're told, is the father of our country. I don't buy that for a second. I don't like the imagery that's given to him in Washington, D.C. I don't need a phallic symbol telling me who the father of the nation is. But so we have Washington as the supposed father of the nation in this God myth of the state. And then Lincoln comes along, and if you look at Lincoln Memorial and then you look at Washington Memorial, then you begin to understand that the real God here in the U.S., in the government of the U.S., the real God here is Lincoln. So it's much like, you know, Saturn and Jupiter. Where Jupiter had to fight and kill Saturn to take over and become king of all the gods, or the same thing with Zeus and Cronus, where Zeus had to, you know, Cronus was the father god, and Zeus had to defeat him, con him into, well, no, I guess the mother conned him into swallowing the rock. But anyway, however that goes. But still, we have the myth of the state depends on this hero god, and a living president, as much as people may, you know, idolize Obama or Bush before him, or Clinton before him, or Bush before him, or Bush the next time around when Jeb Bush wins it the next time. As much as there's idolizing of the existing president, this state myth needs a hero god bigger than the existing human that we see, because the living president is only a representative of this god. It's like idolatry, where you have the statue represents the god, but the belief in the god is what makes the god real, makes him magical. Well, that's what we have with Abraham Lincoln. Abraham Lincoln is the god of the state. That's why he's seated on the throne. He's seated in the throne of Jupiter in Washington, D.C. And if you look at imagery of the Roman god of Jupiter, how he's seated in his temple and so forth, and then look at Abraham Lincoln seated in his temple in Washington, D.C. Now, some people can say, and one of the things about Lincoln that a lot of people don't realize is just how horrible of a racist that he really was. I mean, seriously, I'm not going to get into all of the levels of this, but the amount that he hated blacks and the amount that he hated American Indians was real vivid in his writings. And again, you can go to the references on that without me actually pulling up individual letters and speeches and everything. And some of the, some of the Lincoln, the people who are part of the Lincoln cult today, they'll try to apologize for racism and say, well, it was part of the culture of the day. Yeah, but you can only take that excuse so far. You can only excuse evil to a certain extent by saying, well, they had a different understanding back then than we have now. We're so much more enlightened now than we were then. Well, to a certain extent, you can excuse some evil like that. But to a certain extent, you can't either. Evil is still evil, no matter what the understanding of the day happens to be. But the thing with Lincoln is that he made his intentions clear. He was a racist, like lots of people in the North were racists at the time. He didn't want people of African descent in America. He made that very clear in his speeches. He made that clear over and over. He feared intermarriage between blacks and whites. He feared black people having a vote. He was terrified of black people serving on juries and just aghast at the idea that there might be a black judge someday making a decision over a white person. He said all these things. This is not, you know, it's not taught in schools that he said these things, and it's often denied by court historians, but it's all right there in black and white, and you can read it for yourself if you read his actual writings and his actual speeches. He literally wanted all black people rounded up and deported to Africa. That's what he wanted. Now, some people will say that he changed his mind later in life, but his personal correspondences show that right up to months before his death, he still had plans to deport all black people. Remember, even in the Lincoln-Douglas debates, that he said that he believed whites were a superior race and that blacks were naturally a subservient race. So you can't just explain this away and say, well, it was because of the thinking of the day. No, that's racism. That's racism no matter what age that you're living in. If you want to round people up and ship them off or get rid of them in some other way because you've decided that they're subservient to you, I mean, what do you call that? How is that different from, you know, what, 60, 70, 80, 90 years later, Hitler used the same excuse to kill 6 million Jews. So, you know, how is 90 years in any way justify this kind of evil? So Lincoln's aggression. Let's get into that and move away from his horrible racial position. Lincoln's aggression. Now, so why is it called a civil war? It clearly wasn't a civil war. Why is it called a civil war? A civil war, like a revolution, is where there is a local uprising against the government. Okay, I had to break there for a second. It's the first Wednesday of the month, and that's when they test the disaster siren here locally. So I had dogs going nuts and sirens ringing and the whole world falling apart. So then, why do they call it a civil war? Well, a civil war, of course, is when the population turns against the government. And typically, you have a situation where, you know, like what happened in North Africa and the different countries, like specifically Egypt. Egypt would be the best example of a civil war in North Africa, where, you know, at first it was the civilian population that turned against the government. And then eventually the military stepped in, and oftentimes the military will go one direction or the other. And that's the way, at that point it becomes a revolution, and either the, you know, the old government is toppled and a new government is set up, or the old government squashes the revolution. But the so-called Civil War was not a revolution, and it was not a civil war. So why did they insist on naming it wrong? Well, there's a reason for this. You see, the Supreme Court had said that neither Congress nor the president has the constitutional right to make war on any city, a state, or even a group of states. The Supreme Court had already made that decision. However, the Supreme Court said at the same in the same ruling that Congress can authorize a defensive war against rebels who act in a revolution. You see that? Bingo. We have a little word game going on here. So the Supreme Court says that you can't go to war against a city or a state or a group of states if they're in the, you know, for example, if they're seceding. But if they're in revolution, now we can do pretty much anything we want. So you see how the words of the Constitution can be twisted around, and it doesn't matter how clear you write it or how foggy you write it. Words can be twisted around, and once you decide to write stuff on paper and call it the law, what you've actually done is created the opportunity to skirt that law. That's really all it is. So, for example, we can have Afghan freedom fighters welcomed into Reagan's White House and have a picture, you know, photo op with Reagan sitting with these Afghan freedom fighters, and he can say things like, these are like the founding fathers of our country, and so all that kind of stuff. And then we just switch the titles when these horrible people kill the poppy production in Afghanistan, and they outlaw the production of poppies. Then all of a sudden, they're terrorists. See, when they shut down the poppy production, it kills the CIA's cash cow in Afghanistan. Then all of a sudden, those evil terrorists over there, something has to be done about them. You see how just changing the wording magically justifies aggression. Well, that's what happened. That's why it's called the Civil War and why it's not called, you know, anything else. It could be named a dozen different things. And that's why I believe so many people try to twist the meaning of these words and call the American War of Independence, why they call it a revolution. It wasn't, the American War of Independence wasn't a revolution. Nobody in the United States, nobody in the colonies, that is, attempted to take over the government in London. It didn't happen. So it wasn't a revolution. It was a war of independence. And that's what the so-called Civil War would have been. It would have been a war of Southern independence, had it not gone horribly wrong. So in 1861, I call this tariff, I call it the Morrill Tariff. Most people I've heard pronounce it say the Morrill Tariff, but it looks to me more like Morrill, M-O-R-R-I-L-L. And it seems kind of, it doesn't seem right to call it a Morrill Tariff anyway. That's sort of a contradiction in terms. But anyway, this 1861 Morrill Tariff, James Buchanan signed it into law before he left the White House, before Lincoln was sworn in. But there had been a lot of talk about it ahead of time. It had already passed, you know, the House of Representatives. It had passed the Senate. And all that had taken place in 1860. And there was a lot of talk about the tariff. The tariff had existed, not the Morrill tariff, but an earlier version of it, had existed for some time. And it put an average of about a 15% tariff on goods. And this was really... It was unproportional. It wasn't balanced. It was done. The tariff was done in a way, and this is the old tariff prior to the Morrill tariff. The tariff was done in such a way that most of the tax burden was placed on the southern states, and very little of the tax burden was placed on the northern states. Now, keeping in mind that at the time the only constitutional tax allowed. Remember, the Whiskey Rebellion was over an unconstitutional whiskey tax, and that was eventually kicked out as being unconstitutional. So the only constitutional tax was a tariff, and so in 1860, the tariff that was about, like I said, about 15% was constitutional, but this Morrill tariff boosted that initially up to 38%. In some places, it was much higher. But in addition to boosting the tariff from 15 to 38%, it also expanded the list of items covered in the tariff. So really, the tax burden on southern states had basically tripled with the passage of the Morrill tariff. Overall, the southern states were already paying about 80% of all the federal tariffs. And keep in mind also that about 73% of the federal budget came from the tariffs. And keep in mind, like I said a second ago, the tariff was absolutely constitutional. As bad as it was, the tariff did not provide any legal framework for secession. The tariff could have been 100%. It could have been a 100% tariff. It still would have been constitutional. There is nothing the southern states could constitutionally do about 100% tariff, had one existed, other than appealing and trying to get a vote through Congress to have it lowered, because there was nothing unconstitutional about the tariff. Now, why is that important? Well, I'll get to it when I come back from this break. Stick with me. I'll be right back. Would you like to do something to support BadQuaker.com? Here's how easy it is. If you're already going to buy something from Amazon, go to BadQuaker.com first. Click on any of the buttons for Amazon. Once at Amazon, shop like you normally would. You'll pay the same price for the things you buy from Amazon, but Amazon will give BadQuaker.com a tiny portion of that purchase. It's amazingly easy to shop at Amazon, it won't cost you any extra, and you'll be supporting BadQuaker.com. Thank you. Did you know author Taryn P. Lupo has a new novel out called One Nation Under Blood? When a rejuvenative blood technology is developed that pits the young against the old, the government must take firm steps to address the war of supply and demand brewing across generational lines. Blood is not the only thing bought and sold in this dystopian tale of technology, economics, and independence. Vampires are now very real, but we never expected them to wear our grandmother's best Sunday dress. Okay, thanks for sticking with me through the break. Let me give a real quick recap here, and then we'll get back into it. Okay, so the states couldn't legally separate themselves over the tariff, no matter how bad the tariff got. They did not have the legal justification to separate themselves over the tariff, because the tariff was constitutional. Now, we had slavery was a problem, and the plantation system that both created the need for slavery and was propped up by slavery was a problem. And mercantilism was codified by the Constitution. Therefore, slavery and the plantation system, along with mercantilism that supported it, were all constitutional. It was the constitutional system. The non-slave states were forbidden from interfering with slavery, and required to capture and return fleeing slaves to their slave owners. Now, the Constitution was a bit fuzzy on the wording on this, probably intentionally, because that's what the framers of the Constitution loved, to write things in fuzzy words so that it could be twisted in any way that they needed at the time. But essentially, it was the general understanding at the time of the writing that non-slave states were forbidden from interfering with slavery and required to capture and return fleeing slaves. So then, in Lincoln's first inaugural address, he basically said, you know, slavery is a-okay with me, but the tariff will be enforced by the military if need be. And you can read Lincoln's first inaugural address for yourself. I really don't have time to read the whole thing on the podcast today. I will give a little quote out of it. He said, "The power confided in me will be used to hold, occupy, and possess the property and places belonging to the government, and to collect the duties, imposts, But beyond what may be necessary for these objects, there will be no invasion, no using of force against or among the people anywhere." So he's saying right there, have your slavery. I don't care. That's fine. Whatever. I'm not going to mess with your slavery. He said this clearly in his inaugural address, not only the part that I quoted, but in the rest of it. But he also said clearly, he put a threat there. He said, we're gonna collect the tariff. We're going to, if we have to put military in every doorway, we're going to collect the tariff. And that's why Lincoln was elected. That was the power behind getting him the votes and getting him the financial support to get him elected. Again, you need to get your hands on Lincoln Uncensored by Joseph Fallon, because it contains all these different speeches and his letters and everything like that. It's a really good source that you can get to without without having to fight through all the layers and layers of propaganda that usually go with all things Lincoln. So then the South was being double taxed by the tariff on things bought and sold, imports and exports. Pretty much everything that they did in the South got taxed in one way or the other by the tariff. And the money was given primarily to corrupt corporations and bankers. It was used in northern construction projects, canals, northern railroads, northern shipbuilding, and northern ports. It was used to influence, to buy votes, to buy, positions for all the northern politicians. This is where all the tax money was going to. It was not going into the South. The South was making the money, and the North was not. And so this was a way for the North literally to finance itself on slavery. If you think about it, if the North is saying, okay, you guys have slaves down there, and the North doesn't have slaves, so we're going to tax you and take a bunch of the money you make from slavery. You see how that works? So the North was literally, they were fine with there being slaves as long as they got their cut of the deal, see? Now, one of the things that Fallon shows in his book is that before Lincoln's inauguration, before he even gave that speech, he was already in negotiations with Southerners, people in Virginia and in other states in the South. And the idea was he offered them to allow the Southern states to secede peaceably if they agreed to continue paying the tariff. But that would have made the South more like a colony of the North. It was really only when the South refused to pay the tariff under any circumstances that Lincoln switched his song and he started talking about saving the Union. Prior to that, it was all about the tariff. And again, Fallon uses Lincoln's letters to show that leading Republicans in the day were urging Lincoln to seek a compromise with the South. But Lincoln felt that that war was a better idea, because Lincoln felt that war would put the Republicans. Keep in mind, Lincoln was not elected with a majority. There was a three-way split on the vote, and he barely got elected. So the Republican Party was not very strong when Lincoln was first elected. But Lincoln believed that if he could successfully wage war on the South, that he would be able to solidify the Republican Party in control of the government. And Lincoln was right. That's exactly what he did. The Republicans held complete control of Washington for the next 50 years. So you begin to see what I've been saying about all these wars. Every single war that the United States government engaged itself in was a war about power and money. Power to the politicians and money to the bankers and industrialists that made a fortune off of these wars. And again, like I said in the other podcasts, the American War of Independence was not fought by the U.S. government. The U.S. government didn't exist yet. So I'm not commenting on the War of Independence. I'm talking about every war that the United States government has engaged itself in has been a war based around the desire for power and key bankers and industrialists filling their pockets with money. So a little bit of a timeline here. Lincoln was elected in November of 1860. South Carolina declared its independence a month later, December 20th, 1860. So this is before Lincoln was even inaugurated. South Carolina was already had already declared its independence. Now, if you read the South Carolina's Declaration of Independence, you'll find some interesting discussion in there. There was at the time there was a disagreement whether the Constitution was a compact or whether it was a contract. And this difference of wording again is critical in how you look at the Constitution, because if it's a compact, then South Carolina had the right to just step away from it at any particular time. But if it's a contract, then as long as the contract is valid, no parties have broke the contract, then no parties can break the contract rightfully, legally. So in other words, if I make a contract with you and I say, okay, I'm going to supply you with apples and you're going to supply me with tacos, and we make a contract that says, okay, the exchange rate is going to be 2 tacos for each apple, and so we make a contract on this, and then one day I'm just like, you know what, I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to trade anymore with you. Well, then I've broken that contract, and I've broken the law, essentially, whether anybody writes the law or not. I've broken true law because I've broke my contract with you. Well, according to how you look at the Constitution, whether it's a contract or a compact, you know, Lincoln argued that it was a contract, that once entered, it couldn't just be walked away from. That was Lincoln's argument. So South Carolina pulled a really, really fun little trick. You see, legally, the South could do nothing about the tariff. The tariff, no matter if it was, like I said, 100%, it was not grounds for secession. It was not grounds to break the Constitution, if the Constitution was indeed a contract. And since that was under dispute, whether it was a compact or a contract, since that was under dispute, South Carolina had a little trick up their sleeve. You see, the loophole was that the Constitution, the constitutional issue of the returning of fugitive slaves, because, again, the Constitution allowed the tariff, but the Constitution also required that northern states return fugitive slaves. And they hadn't been. So if you read South Carolina's Declaration of Independence, it uses the word compact over and over, and it makes the argument that it always had the right to secede. But then it lays down the argument that the northern states had already openly engaged in breaking the Constitution. Therefore, whether the Constitution was a compact or a contract didn't really matter, because the North had already nullified the Constitution itself through the actions of those northern states by not returning fugitive slaves. So if you read South Carolina's Declaration of Independence, you see all this discussion of slavery, and you're like, see, look at that. It was all about slavery. No, it wasn't. It was about words. It was about playing with words and twisting words, and it was about a poorly written constitution that didn't make it really clear exactly what the thing was. And so they used this loophole in the Constitution to declare their independence from the U.S. government, because the northern states had already broke the contract, or if it's a compact, they have the right either way. So by December of 1860, South Carolina was an independent nation under military occupation by the U.S. government. At the time, as soon as they declared their independence, all U.S. government property was abandoned in South Carolina except one fort, the unfinished Fort Sumter, that was stuck on a little island in the neck of the harbor at Charleston. But the key about that position is that from that little fort, the Union guns could control shipping in and out of the city of Charleston. You see, they could still put the tariff on everything that was coming in or out of the port. So that's why it was critical that Lincoln hold on to Fort Sumter. he didn't have the power to hold on to all the rest of the forts that were around in the area. And there, if you look on Wikipedia and look at a map of the area, you'll see that Fort Sumter was one dot in the middle of the neck of the harbor. And it was just surrounded in every way by other forts that South Carolina controlled. So to have this one fort right in the middle of their harbor, controlling all traffic that could go in and out, that's not a tolerable situation for any sovereign nation. You know, could you imagine there being an American fort right in the harbor of say, oh, I don't know, any nation, Portsmouth Harbor in England, or you know, any place like that? It would not be a tolerable situation, and it certainly wasn't tolerable to an independent South Carolina. So again, this all took place in December, about December 20th thereabouts, with the moving of the troops and so forth. But in December of 1860, all that took place. Well, February 2nd of 1861, 2 months later, Texas signed their Ordinance of Secession and officially separated Texas from the United States. Now, here's two states. Here's South Carolina and Texas, both officially and legally separating themselves from the United States. And the United States government essentially did nothing about that, because they couldn't, really. Texas actually was, even no matter how you argue the contract or compact argument, Texas still, because of the way it was taken into the Union, it had the legal right to leave the Union at any point in time. So the U.S. government had basically nothing they could say or do legally about Texas leaving the Union. Well, that was February 2nd. February 4th, Mississippi, Florida, Alabama, and Georgia and Louisiana, they joined South Carolina, and they declared their independence, and they formed, with South Carolina, they formed the Confederacy of States. And just shortly after that, Texas joined the Confederacy as well. Now, this happened on February 4th. On February 13th, 1861, the delegates from all the counties of Virginia met to decide how Virginia would respond to the Confederacy. And they voted to stay in the Union. And this is really interesting, because keep in mind that it had been Lincoln communicating with key political figures in Virginia that had pushed them to believe that, and they mostly did believe, that there would be a compromise reached as soon as Lincoln, you know, officially came in and took over, that there would be some kind of a compromise reached, and there and Lincoln would defuse this situation. Well, on March 4th, you know, so this is, you know, December, South Carolina's out, February 2nd, Texas is out, February 4th, Mississippi, Florida, Alabama, Georgia, Louisiana, they're all out. February 13th, Virginia decides to stay in the Union, and March 4th rolls around, and Lincoln is sworn in as president, and he gives his inaugural speech, assuring the whole nation that war is not his intent, and that he has neither the power nor the desire to interfere with this on the issue of slavery, that his only care is about this tariff and about enforcing the tariff. And he gives this not-so-veiled threat that, sure, you can break off, you can have slaves, you can not have slaves, you can do whatever you want, but I'm going to protect what he's calling, you know, U.S. government property, which he was specifically talking about Fort Sumter, and he's going to collect the tariff. He's going to collect the tariff by having a fort in the middle of one of the biggest ports in the South and making sure that every boat going in and out is inspected and pays its tariff, right? Now, at this point, we really need to jump back to John Denson's book, A Century of War, Lincoln, Wilson, and Roosevelt. Because if you really doubt what I'm saying, or if you really don't, if you're not sure about what I'm saying, if you're not comfortable with what I'm saying, pick up that book. It's a little book. It's not very expensive. It's easy to read through. It's written really well. And he goes, John Denson goes point by point, and Lincoln's War is only just the first little part, and I'm going to rely a lot on it when I get around to the December 7th podcast on Pearl Harbor. But John Denson goes point by point and shows each time Lincoln lied, each time he used deception, each time he would openly lie. Each time he would give opposite promises to different people, telling one person, yeah, we're not going to supply the fort. We're going to pull the guys out of Sumter. And then tell another guy, yeah, stay in there. You stay right to the end. We're going to supply you. You just stay right there. We'll be with you. And he just lies back and forth to these people. He intentionally left those guys in Fort Sumter, knowing that South Carolina could not tolerate that situation. He promised to take him out, and then he didn't follow through on that. He pretended to send food to them, and he claimed to the northern newspapers that they were starving. But he knew the whole time that was a lie. You see, the people of Charleston were actually taking food out to those soldiers, and they were eating. The South Carolina would not allow military ships to come in and supply the fort, because what are they going to bring in? They're going to bring in troops. They're going to bring in ammunition. But why would you let the fort be supplied in that way? So they weren't starving. Lincoln knew that was a lie, but he was telling that to newspapers anyway. And then Lincoln took the next step. Any newspaper that didn't give out his story, his version of the events, he started arresting the newspaper editors. Anybody who told the truth about the situation, Lincoln would just have them arrested. Eventually, Lincoln arrested the entire state government of Maryland. He just had them all just rounded up and arrested. They weren't charged with anything. They were held through the entire war without being charged with anything. And just like that, just his will, just the will of the president to do that. He used military to burn northern newspaper offices and smash the presses that didn't support him. He used the U.S. military to enforce voting, and he controlled the polling places in the North to make sure that he got reelected. All this is in... Now, John Denson doesn't go into that part. You're going to have to get that from Tom DeLorenzo. But all of it's documented. He did use the military. You know, they had like, if you're going to vote for Lincoln, it was one color of a ballot. And if you were going to vote for against Lincoln, it was a different colored ballot. And then the military stood there and watched as you walked up and put your ballot into the box. And so they knew, who to allow to go vote and who not to allow to vote. And so Lincoln won the next election just by the use of the military like that. A lot of people don't realize, too, that not only did Lincoln violate the law and set up the greenbacker currency, just, you know, issuing fiat currency out of the power of the government to do so, and that's where we get the greenbacker, you know, supporters today. But not only did he do that, Lincoln also enacted the draft, and then he, when there were draft marches, and, you know, anti-draft marches in New York City and so forth, he and even the mayor of New York City openly talked about, you know, a seceding from the Union. And so what does he do? He has the mayor of New York arrested, and he brings federal troops into New York City, and they had martial law throughout the war in New York City. And U.S. military troops brutally suppressed the residents of New York City. And essentially, New York became, you know, a compound. It became a military camp throughout the war. Now, in addition to all that stuff, you know, Kentucky, for instance, never left the Union. Kentucky, some people consider Kentucky a southern state. It was a border state. It was a slave state. But Kentucky never left the Union. And yet Lincoln sent Union troops into Kentucky to raid homes and farms. And they were given orders to take as much as possible and smash or burn whatever they couldn't carry. Under Lincoln's supervision, the U.S. Army General Order Number 100 was abandoned. That was basically the way that war had been carried out through civilized nations, where war is strictly a matter of soldier against soldier. Well, Lincoln abandoned that, and he adopted the new policy of total war, which meant that civilians were intentionally targeted. And he did. He intentionally targeted civilians, intentionally burned farms, intentionally, you know, blew up houses. The horrible, I can't really get into it because of time, but Sherman's horrible march to the sea and the result of, you know, what happened in Savannah and other cities like that, it was unbelievable, the brutality. and how Lincoln just, you know, they try to portray him as being this thoughtful man and this kind man, but he was a monster. He was an absolute monster, and you can see that if you read the books that I'm talking about there, Real Lincoln and the others that I mentioned. Lincoln was every bit a puppet of the banking and railroad and timber and steel corporations, and that's really what it was all about, because all those were northern corporations, and he basically looted the South to support those corporations and the northern bankers. And again, if there's any doubt about what I'm talking about, check out those four books, A Century of War, Lincoln, Wilson, and Roosevelt by John Denson, Lincoln Unmasked and the Real Lincoln by Tom DeLorenzo, and Lincoln Uncensored by Joseph Fallon. I'll have links to all those in the podcast notes for today, available at badquaker.com. And one more time, you know, the whole purpose here, these are lies used to justify war. It wasn't about slavery. It was about the transition of America from a mercantile system into a new fascist system. It was very much about that. It was about the crushing of the Constitution and the complete disregard of the Constitution. It was about the federal government becoming powerful enough that it didn't have to pay attention to the Constitution ever again, really. That's what the war was about. It was about money, and it was about power. And everything else that has been written about Lincoln and about that his so-called Civil War, even to the point of twisting the name of the thing in to try to justify the aggression that Lincoln put upon America, the murdering of somewhere between 700 and 800,000 Americans died so that Lincoln could gain more power and so that Lincoln's financial backers could gain more money. And the funny thing is, When he finally put South Carolina into a position where they had to attack Fort Sumter, then what did he do? He used that great American president line that we are already in a state of war. That was his excuse, because he was able to make it appear as though someone else threw the first punch, when actually it was Lincoln that did it. So consider what you've been taught about the so-called Civil War. And consider what you've been taught about Lincoln, and consider popular movies and how they portray him nowadays and all these kind of things. And then realize for yourself. Now, this is not a condemnation of American culture or the American people. It's a condemnation of the U.S. government and the religious notion that having faith in the concept of the state is anything other than an act of blasphemy. Now, stick with me. Come back for the last episode of this on, I don't even know if it'll be the last episode. I might just keep going with this series because, you know, I could do four or five just on World War I and World War II alone. But be sure and get back on the 7th and hear the one on Pearl Harbor to wrap this up. Folks, thank you very much for listening to BadQuaker.com, where liberty is our mission.